You are Locked On Marlins, your daily podcast on the Miami Marlins. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
This is the Locked On Marlins podcast, your go-to podcast on all things Miami Marlins. As always, I'm your host, Aram Layton. I'm a longtime Marlins writer, as well as the founder of JustBaseball.com. And in today's episode, we are going to talk a little bit about the Marlins Game 1 victory in the series against the Dodgers, which gives me a bit more of a positive flair to this, as if I recorded it right after the game against the Braves, that would have been a much more miserable and negative episode. But I am still going to talk about I'm still going to talk about that game against the Braves because there was a lot to unpack there. I mean, a rubber match, you're winning by four, ninth inning, and all you have to do is not give up four runs and you win the series against the Braves, who are clearly struggling. They got trounced by the Pirates yesterday. They look really, really bad. So I want to talk about that, the NL East as a whole, because I did say, and I do stand by it, that was a season-defining loss. But that being said, the Marlins have about 3 weeks' worth of games to be able to right the ship a little bit, and they have been playing good baseball. I would say that loss, if they had not bounced back against the Dodgers and won there, we'll see how they do on the next three ball games. If they're able to split with the Dodgers, if they take three out of four, remember, this was a team that had won nine straight after getting no hit. That would definitely change the tides a little bit for the Marlins as they have some more division games coming up heading into the All-Star break and outside of the All-Star break, and then more games against the Braves, who again look really, really bad. And the NL East looks pretty vulnerable as a whole. Even the Mets, who are in first place and getting healthier, are still struggling to really separate themselves. I mean, the Nationals, the Braves, and the Phillies all sit between four and four and a half games behind the Mets, who have also been a bit inconsistent over the last 10. They're just 5-5. The entire division is either 5-5 or 6-4 over the last 10 games. The Marlins could have had an opportunity there to climb a bit closer. That's one of those one-game swings that make a big difference, right? The Marlins would be 9 games under 500 instead of 11 and would be within 3.5 games of the Braves and 4 games of the Nationals for second place had they won that ball game. All that being said, they are 9 games behind the Mets, which is a good deal of games, right? But you go on a nice little stretch, you can get that within 6. And I think if you're within 6 games at the deadline, and keep in mind, if you're within 6 games of the Mets, you're going to be right in the thick of it for second place as well, which you don't get a consolation prize for second place, but you can largely just set your sights on the Mets. And if you're playing good baseball, you're just focused on catching them. I think you have the confidence that you can outpace a Nationals team that just lost Kyle Schwarber, a Braves team that is just not playing well and has their own issues, and also a Phillies team that I don't love the Phillies much at all, and I just don't really think that they are going to put it together. I mean, they have a negative 21 run differential, and I know we jokingly talk about run differential, but the Phillies are just not a great team. They are able to squeeze out some wins here and there. For the contrast there, the Marlins have a 21 run positive run differential, just pretty crazy. But the Marlins have to play better away from home. They're 17-29, and they are much more effective at home at 19-18 because of the fact that their offense is relatively meager everywhere, even at home or on the road. Whether they're playing in Denver or on the moon, the offense is a bit inconsistent, but the pitching is really good everywhere, but elite at home, and that's the difference. They win those closer games, those one-run games a bit more frequently at home. But anyways, let's talk about that Braves atrocity. I will try not to spend too much time on that. Then I'm going to talk about the positive in that Marlins victory over the Dodgers that legitimately almost stopped my heart, but then they were able to pull it off. I mean, if they blew that one too, which I think everybody, I don't know, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I was fully prepared for that to be just another blown game. But that would have been one that would have been more understandable just because they had legitimately nobody. I mean, Anthony Bender threw with his arm hanging essentially, but that's something that I want to talk about with this Braves game, is because the Marlins didn't have a lot at their disposal, right? They got screwed in game one by Pablo Lopez getting ejected with the first pitch. And that's another thing I didn't really get a chance to talk about too much. Pablo Lopez getting ejected on the first pitch. I'm going to try to be pretty quick with this because all of a sudden I have a million topics to discuss and I'm excited about all of them. But with Pablo Lopez, look, I understand why everybody would be upset on the Braves side of things. It's the first pitch of the damn game and you hit Ronald Acuna for what seems like the 100th time. It seems like the 100th time because Ronald Acuna makes a big scene every time it happens. But on the flip side, it is worth acknowledging that almost every single time Acuna gets drilled, it's going to be with a heater because the Marlins are trying to go hard with hard stuff in under the hands, and it works. We've seen it work. It's worked late in ball games with the Marlins relievers who seem to be better at doing it, better at getting that hard fastball up and in under his hands. I mean, I tweeted out a picture of Acuna getting frozen on a fastball up and in at the top quadrant of the strike zone, and you can see him starting his swing and just doesn't quite get himself to pull the trigger, but because of the way that he dives back over the plate and starts his swing, his elbow was about 6 inches from the baseball, maybe less than that. I would say maybe even 3 to 4 inches from touching that baseball. So it's kind of tough when you are dancing between a fine line of 3-4 inches of hitting a strike there on the inside corner or hitting Ronald Acuna, and that's part of the problem. But also, something I want to acknowledge as well is that I was watching the Marlins broadcast in the subsequent game. And yes, I know I'm briefly talking about this too, but the Marlins broadcast talked about Ronald Acuna and the whole thing about him getting hit and the Marlins situation. And I get you have to talk about it, but I'm pretty sure they talked about it for what was about 4 innings, including a pregame full breakdown by Holly on why Acuna gets hit a lot and why it's hard to pitch him in and why you want to pitch him in. Look, I understand that it's an important topic, but my goodness, at 3-4 innings into the game, I don't want to hear it anymore. Especially then he goes yard and that's why you don't pitch him there. Obviously, that's why you don't pitch him there. And I get it. It's frustrating and it is what it is, but it's going to resurface itself enough as is. I would rather just talk about the ball game and just talk about what's going on and not spend 3-4 innings. I mean, you know, you have Holly go on those rants where he is on a monologue for several pitches in a row and Paul can't even call the game. And so you just have a monologue over basically the active game going on, and that's a bit frustrating. So I understand that those are topics we want to talk about, and that's something I had to briefly mention. But all I'll say about that is to eject Pablo Lopez is outrageous. And the reason why they did is because Snitker came out, you know, pitched a fit. And I don't know what he said, but I'm sure that the umpires realized, okay, this is going to get to MLB. This is going to get to the MLB office. And if we don't manage this properly, if this gets worse, if this escalates, if Acuna gets hit again, whatever it may be, baseball is not going to be happy that we did not properly protect one of the best players in the game. And I think that the safe option for them to cover their asses was to eject Pablo Lopez on one pitch into the game. But when have pitchers ever been ejected based on lack of command? That's never been something that I've seen. I've seen pitchers get ejected because of intent, right? But nobody, not even the Braves, were disputing the intent there from Pablo Lopez. I don't think anybody, not even Ronald Acuna, thought that Pablo Lopez hit him on purpose. I think Acuna was more so just like, okay, can you stop hitting me here? I get you want to pitch me in. Just stop hitting me, which I understand from his perspective, but he's also armored up for a reason. But with the whole decision there to eject Pablo, we live in an era right now in baseball where hit by pitches are more rampant than ever before, and pitchers are just not as good at commanding their heaters as they ever have. Pablo Lopez is one of the most frequent pitch inside type of guys that you're going to find, and that's exactly what happens there. But we see pitchers, we've seen starting pitchers hit 2, 3, sometimes 4 batters in a single start. Do those guys get ejected? No, because it's an accident, right? I know that there's the history there, and the history does lead into it a little bit. But if the initial reaction wasn't to even issue a warning, then why are we going into this situation here where you don't issue a warning, you all of a sudden have a little powwow, and not only do you just skip the warning, you eject him immediately? That's just crazy to me, and that's just the one thing I wanted to talk about there. But let's go into this Braves series, because I think the Marlins played really well overall in that series. Obviously, the relievers were a bit inconsistent, and a big part of that problem has been their two high-paid, quote-unquote, relievers in this Marlins back end of the bullpen. It's Anthony Bass and Yimi Garcia. And if you remember heading into this year, and this was something that I harped on a lot, and I admittedly, when he got off to a hot start, Garcia that is, I was like, oh, maybe I was wrong about this. But I was pretty, I had a lot of conviction in that take that I have not been encouraged from what I saw at the back end of the season from Yimi Garcia and from what I saw heading into the season and just in the beginning of the year where I just felt like he was flying by the seat of his pants. I thought he was getting a bit lucky. I'm not the biggest Yimi Garcia guy. I think he's an okay seventh inning guy if he can really just find that comfort in the seventh inning. He's definitely not a closer, and I was pretty consistent with my questioning of him, and I thought maybe this could be the Brandon Kinsler situation 2.0 where he just proves me wrong, and it seemed like that for about a month, and then now it seems like my concerns are pretty valid. Over his last 15 games, he has a 6.75 ERA. He has given up 14 hits, 10 earned runs, 8 walks, and 13 and a third innings. That's good for a 1.65 whip. Over his last 7 games, he has gone 6 innings. He's given up 6 earned runs, along with 3 walks and 9 hits. That's good for a 2.00 whip. So it's been a bad stretch for Yimi Garcia, but I, again, really had my concerns going into the end of last year that he was due for a major regression, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. There's no doubt you got to take this guy out of the closer role. To go to Anthony Bass, by the way, as well. Anthony Bass, and I don't need to talk much else other. I don't even need to go into the stats. Anthony Bass needed to get Max Fried out to extend the ball game. Pinch hitter, Max Fried, and he couldn't. And I think that's just kind of a microcosm on the entire year for Anthony Bass. He's been miserable, and it's been frustrating, and he's under contract next year as well. So the Marlins have some stuff to figure out there. But that being said, let's look at the game, because the Marlins' offense was spectacular. They were really darn good, and they wore out Charlie Morton. It was a good old-fashioned what should have been victory, right? You are facing a tough starter in Charlie Morton, who's been great over the last handful of starts and solid all year. The book on Morton is that he struggles, at least in this stage of his career, the third time through the lineup. And the Marlins were able to wear him out a little bit. They scratched across for one in the fourth. And at the very worst, they were going to get him out of the ballgame, whether they hit him around in the sixth or not, at least before the seventh inning, which is good because the Braves bullpen, we talk about the Marlins bullpen being bad, the Braves bullpen's been really bad as well. That was a strength for them last year, a weakness for them this year. And going into the game, we knew that the Marlins were going to be a bit limited in terms of who their relievers would be that were available. And also, by the way, Zach Thompson, absolutely spectacular again. He just adapts every single start, right? He went from his previous start racking up 11 strikeouts, and I talk about the things that he has to do to get lefties out, going more with a vertical curveball, and that worked really well for him. He got 6 whiffs, 10 called strike whiffs on that against the Nationals. Then he shows up in this Braves outing, a team that hits changeups really well, and he goes changeup heavy. He doesn't care. He's not scared of you, and he gets 6 whiffs on the changeup. To put it in perspective, he'd only thrown the changeup 10 times all year prior, so really impressive stuff from him. But anyways, the offense finally comes through, scores 3 in the sixth off Morton, and then gets 3 insurance runs in the ninth. And that's where you're like, okay, they are in good shape here. But Yimi Garcia goes out there, and you're thinking, okay, this might be a bit of an adventure, but thank goodness they've got a nice little 4-run cushion. Not enough. Not enough at all. They end up blowing that lead. But the interesting thing here was, yes, I understand that you went to Bender earlier, and that was fine because that was one of the tougher stretches in the lineup, and that was probably the right move. The tough part is that I think Yimi Garcia was left in there way too long. I know that the Marlins did not really have anybody available and that they were very limited in that regard, but I would have went to Okert at that point. Like, there's outings where Yimi goes out there and you know if he's got it or if he doesn't, and he did not have it, and you could tell it right from the get-go. He couldn't throw strikes. He just didn't look good. The velo was not even totally there for him. The stuff didn't look great, and again, he just could not throw strikes. He walked 3 and gave up 4 hits in that one inning. The fact that the Marlins didn't lose it right then and there was a miracle in itself, and I think when you can see him, I know you got to get somebody up quickly at that point, but when you see him struggling like that, I think that you kind of know the writing's on the wall. You had time to be able to get somebody up and quickly get him in the game, right? It wasn't like the Marlins had a 1-run lead. They had a 4-run lead. So they could have through those struggles, Amiami Garcia squeezed in a mound visit in between, a little bit of gamesmanship, and then I know you're limited on the amount of mound visits nowadays. I don't know how many they had left at that point. I'm assuming they had at least more than one, and they could have gone and instead, you know, brought in that guy, Okert, who's nasty, by the way. Do you see how many fly balls he gets? Weak fly balls and swings and misses. He's tough. He's really tough. I'm assuming Don wanted to stick with Yimmy because of his success against Ronald Acuna in recent history, and I get that, but it didn't look like he was going to have success against anybody at that point in the ballgame, and I just didn't really like that move to just keep him in there. But we know that Don Mattingly will fall on his sword for his guys, and he will not go to other options. He will legitimately just sink on the ship with them, and that's exactly what happened there. And then ultimately, Anthony Bass cannot get Max Fried out. But on the other side of things, offense was good, 12 hits, they scored 7 runs. Unfortunately, not enough, but it was a good game all around from the Marlins hitters outside of Jesus Sanchez, who struggled in that one. And I've been encouraged overall by Sanchez, but my gosh, can that guy just hit the ball in the air? I think I'd be thrilled to watch him fly out just 4 times. Go 0-for-4 with 4 flyouts. That'd be great for me. Just the bat path there is pretty absurd and pretty steep, and that's a whole nother topic as well. But let's talk about the positives, right? The Marlins pick up the victory against the Dodgers, and they're able to bounce back there and pick up a really encouraging win against Walker Buehler. I thought the offense, that was as good of a ball game as I've seen the Marlins play maybe this year. I know that they blew the lead, but that was one that was, again, much more understandable, right? Because you're going to a guy you just acquired in David Hess, who is not good, by the way. I know I didn't really talk about that trade yet, and yeah, that I don't expect him to hang around very long. I think he's going to be going back to AAA pretty soon, and the Marlins are going to have to shuffle around a little bit and make some moves to probably freshen up this bullpen with the guys that they have that might be able to be optioned in the meantime. I think that's something that we'll have to see how that all goes for them. But I've been really impressed with Okert. He's got that deception from the left side, that three-quarters release, kind of similar to what you see from Trevor Rogers. The difference is he goes more breaking ball and the fastball plays as well. But it's been a very, very tough stretch for the bullpen, again, because you can hide behind bullpen ERA, and that's great, right? They are really good in the sixth and seventh inning or whatever it may be. But if you don't invest in guys that are able to shut the door at the back end, then you can't act surprised when you don't have somebody that can shut the door at the back end. That is something that is mental. A lot of it is mental. The last 3 outs are generally the hardest to get, and that's why experienced guys there are really important. The Braves are suffering from the same thing, and they did invest into their bullpen to a degree, but they let Mark Melancon walk, and they've been trying to piece together the closer spot, and it just hasn't quite worked as well for them. But anyways, speaking of closers, Anthony Bender, that's got to be the closer moving forward. If the Marlins are winning today and Anthony Bender doesn't come in at closer, it's because he's thrown a bajillion pitches over the last few games. But he came in with his arm hanging and still picked up his first career save against the defending World Series champs. So, I mean, Bender, clear, far and away, the closer for this team. And if they don't do that, if they don't roll with Bender moving forward, they're out of their freaking minds. If they put out Anthony Bass or Yimi Garcia for another save opportunity once Bender is rested and ready to go, that is just going to be a disgrace. I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll talk about the offense now. The offense was great. They wore out Walker Buehler. They were making him work. They were working the count. He only goes 5 innings, and they didn't strike out that much. 6 Ks against Buehler in 5 innings. They picked up 5 hits. They worked a couple walks. I really was impressed with Garrett Cooper as well, who is quietly, and not even that quietly for Marlins fans though, he's hitting .500 over his last 9 games, 11 for his last 22. It's been a fantastic stretch for him. And then also, Jazz Chisholm starting to come together again at the plate. It's one of those things where it's just a lot of up and down with Jazz. It's just your typical rookie who comes with some swing and miss concerns. But after striking out in his first 2 at-bats against Walker Buehler, he bounces back and puts a really good swing on a ball to drive in a run. And that's what's the most encouraging thing for me. I'm not going to micromanage Jazz Chisholm's strikeouts, especially against somebody like Walker Buehler. What I am going to look at is, how do you adjust? What do you do about it? And that's exactly what he's impressed me with in that regard. To come back after back-to-back strikeouts and not very good at-bats, to have a great at-bat and drive in a big run for your team, that's something that is really encouraging for me from Jazz Chisholm. Also, Joe Panik, he's been pretty solid for the Marlins. I mean, in the meantime, I've been really encouraged with what he's done defensively. He's been grinding out at bats. He's even stole a pair of bases so far with the Marlins. I think he's a really good bench option. And again, a guy that's really holding them over well until they presumably get Brian Anderson back in 2 to 3 weeks. But panic, again, I even if he's not performing at the highest of levels, even if he's going 1 for 3 in a majority of the games like this, I just like that he is able to basically do a lot of what Corey Dickerson did with a bit more athleticism in the infield because they needed that way more. Trevor Rogers, another spectacular start. I think he was not quite locked in the beginning and then really settled in and started throwing and executing pitches much better after a bit of a rocky start. 5 innings, 6 hits, 2 earned runs, 8 Ks, no walks. And that's been the really encouraging thing from him. The command continues to get better and better. And then Okert, as I mentioned earlier, an inning in a third, 1 strikeout, 1 hit. That's one of the biggest bridges in this game, right? Him being able to go more than an inning and bridge that gap to the back end of the bullpen, which was still going to have to be pieced together between Zach Pop, who was not good, David Hess, who was not good, and then Bender, who was great. And, you know, that was a really big, big outing there from Okert, who has been spectacular so far this season. The Marlins got picked off again. Look, somebody asked me before I recorded, I said, you know, what topics do you want me to talk about? Why are the Marlins getting picked off so much? Brother, I have no freaking clue. No clue. I mean, when you look at like Eysan Diaz, for example, I mean, and that's a portion of the pickoffs. I think he had 3 of them himself. That's an instance of just lapses in attentiveness. And that's something that, you know, comes with the territory a little bit. I think Jesus Sanchez was guilty of that on an occasion as well. With Jazz, it's a bit of just uber aggression, which also comes with the territory a bit too. So, you know, that's part of it. But it just seems like a team-wide contagion when it comes to, and it's probably a poor choice of words in today's day and age, but it just seems like it's been contagious across the team with just one of those things that you see your teammates mess up and then almost it's in the back of your head and it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's the best guess I got for you because I was not the most spectacular baseball player to ever play the game or anything like that. And I also have pretty bad ADHD, or at least I did really bad in high school, have outgrown it a little bit, and I never got picked off. So I don't really know what the excuse is there, but there's definitely a large widespread issue across the team of just them giving away outs on the base paths, which you just can't do that. You just really can't. But for the rest of the team in that game, to wrap it up, I just love the balance through the lineup. I mean, the fact that you were able to get contributions from essentially everybody, 1 through 9, or 1 through 8, I'd say. 9 would be the pitcher who contributed on the mound, as a pitcher should do, and not at the plate. But everybody either added a hit or added a walk and a stolen base or whatever it may be. Jazz Chisholm, 2 for 4. Marte was one of the only guys that didn't have a hit, but he goes 0 for 3 with a walk and stole a base and scored a run. Cooper, 1 for 2 with a pair of walks, gets on base 3 times. Duvall had a hit and a run as well. Miguel Rojas, a hit, a walk, an RBI. Jesus Sanchez, probably the only guy that didn't really contribute anything on either side of the ball. He had a little bit of a lapse in the outfield as well. And my gosh, the guy just legitimately pounds baseballs into the ground. I just think it's a bat path thing and a little bit of the pitches that he chooses to swing at, but it seems like more of a bat path thing. He's got a case of the Eric Hosmers a little bit, but is shorter to the ball than him and has more bat speed, so he can get away with a bit more, but just don't be so steep to the ball. That's just something that's a bit crazy to me that he hasn't worked that out totally yet. And then Joe Panik, 1 for 3 with a run and a stolen base. So overall, a great, great balanced effort from the Marlins offense without Jesus Aguilar in the lineup, which is also encouraging. They're going to have a tough matchup again today, though. They do have their guy Pablo Lopez on the mound, but Tony Gonsolin can throw, and that's going to be an interesting matchup. So on the back end, I want to talk about some of the questions that were brought up to me in terms of the Marlins first base situation next year, maybe Marlins relievers. I know that some people were talking draft and asking me about that, but since I have to do an episode every day this week, I'm going to save draft for another episode either tomorrow or the day after. I know I had floated some Anthony Bender trade discussion. I think they absolutely cannot do that now, and it's becoming unequivocally clear that if you traded Nick Anderson in the past, it's going to take a ridiculous offer to trade Anthony Bender. That being said, if somebody gives you a Jesus Sanchez type offer where you're getting an impact bat or an impact catching prospect, then maybe you got to think about it. But it's going to have to take something insane for me to deal him. And then, of course, I mean, how could I forget Sixto Sanchez? A little bit of my thoughts on the Sixto Sanchez situation now that he is shut down for the season, getting season-ending surgery on that shoulder. I'll try to get to all of that in the last 10 minutes or so. We'll go a little bit longer today on this episode. Quickly, a reminder that this episode is brought to you by BetOnline.ag. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Baseball season's in full swing, and you can track all the action at BetOnline. Get all the latest news, odds, and info for all your sporting needs, including MLB, NBA, NHL, and all of your UFC and MMA action. Before next pitch, head over to BetOnline on your laptop or mobile device and check out all of the sporting news and sign up for bonuses and information. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. This is your chance to get in on the game as teams prep for their runs to the playoffs. Use the promo code LOCKEDON, that's one word, LOCKEDON, for a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's LOCKEDON for a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Also brought to you in part by Built Bar. Built Bar has 9 delicious flavors plus the occasional limited time flavor. And say it with me, they are low in sugar, low in carbs, low in fat, high in protein. What else could you want from a protein bar? They are great for a keto diet because of all the reasons I just mentioned. I didn't even know what a keto diet was before, but apparently they're good for them. And keto diets are good, right? Because they don't have any of those bad things I just mentioned. Also, they're covered in chocolate still and easy to chew. What else could you want from a protein bar? And if you go to builtbar.com right now and use the promo code LOCKED15, that's LOCKED15, you'll get 15% off your next order to choose from flavors like coconut, cherry barcia, raspberry mint brownie, double chocolate, salted caramel, strawberry, orange, cookies and cream, and German chocolate. A lot of good options there. They've got one for everybody. LOCKED15, that's LOCKED15 for 15% off your next order at builtbar.com. So let's get back to baseball here and talk a little bit about some of the questions that were raised for me here, and a lot of topics. I will save some of them because I know that I got to talk about some of this stuff in the next episode in terms of a Starling Marte extension. That's something I want to talk about as well, because the Marlins came in with a bit of a low ball at 3 years, $30 million. He's making $12 million this year, so he would be getting a $2 million pay cut after playing at the level that he is playing at. It's a bit ridiculous. I understand you got to start somewhere, right? So I have said, and I think we could go back, I got to find the receipts, but I believe in the older episodes when I was trying to project the framework of a Marte deal, I said 3 years, 45 to maybe 50. I think the Marlins can get away with 3 years, 45 with the no state income tax. He's getting an extra $5 million or so. I don't know the exact math on that, but he's definitely not getting that haircut on the salary. So between that, the fact that he'll have a little bit of extra change in his pocket from whatever deal he could potentially sign with the Marlins, and the fact that he said he wants to retire here, the Marlins may be able to come in maybe $5 to $8 million cheaper than the other potential deals that he could get elsewhere, but we'll have to see on that. Realistically, the Marlins should be able to make those finances work. And I think if they hide behind the fact that they can't, it's a bit ridiculous to say that. I mean, we're looking at Corey Dickerson, who was getting paid $9 million this year, and the Marlins were able to authorize that deal. Could that deal discourage you from giving a guy like Starling Marte a deal? That was something that Craig Mish had suggested. And look, Mish is the man, and I will believe and listen to every single thing that Craig Mish says. But when it comes to the opinion type stuff like that, you know, everybody's going to have their own take. And in my opinion, I think you can't really lump those things in together. I know that it has to get authorized from the top and all of those things, but it's different when you have had Marte on your team. You're seeing him firsthand as a person, as a player. And that's not to say Corey Dickerson isn't a phenomenal person. I'm sure he is. But when I'm talking about just how he fits in with the clubhouse, how he plays on the field, you're seeing him firsthand day to day, every single day. You are able to make a better call on whether this guy is worth the investment. And I think that it's a little bit of apples to oranges to say, well, the Marlins pay Marte after they were authorized to give the deal to Dickerson and it went poorly. I don't know if those two things are in the same ballpark or in the same conversation whatsoever. Another question that was brought up, and I will definitely talk more about the Marte stuff as it unfolds, but the other question was the Marlins first base situation next year. What do you think they'll do with Lewin Diaz, and will Cooper and Aguilar return? So this is what I would probably do, and it depends on how the next few weeks go. Let's assume the Marlins lose and continue to lose, and I think they're going to, at the very worst, float around 500 the rest of the way and make the decision as just miserable and late as possible. Not because I think the Marlins do everything to just scorn themselves, but just because I think they're playing some good baseball right now, really. And I think that they're going to hang around. If they can get hot, though, and rattle off even just 4 or 5 games over 500 over their next 15, that would be something that could really help them, obviously, and kind of change the tide a little bit. But if they are struggling, I mean, Jesus Aguilar has to be one of the first guys that you deal. He comes pretty cheap in terms of finances, and he comes with control. You can offer him arbitration next year as well. So I think there's going to be value there. He's been one of the more quietly productive players in baseball at first base. He's played really good defense there. He's one of the most likable dudes as well. You can just see that he's charismatic. He's personable. Almost every single team has players hanging out with him at first base, talking to him. He's just such a cool dude. Top of the list of guys I'd love to meet. The fact that he's been so productive, and the fact that he's great for the clubhouse, and that he would add to a winner, and that he can play first base pretty well. He also is more than comfortable DHing. I think there's going to be no shortage of teams that would be interested in him. But I think for the Marlins, it might not be worth it, unless the return is really solid, to trade him if you remotely think you have a chance. I think if you're within 7 games, even around the deadline time, within 6.5, 6 games, you got to just hold on to him at that point, unless there is just a really solid offer from a team that really just wants him. Honestly, the Brewers are a great, great fit for him. They need a guy that can swing the bat at first base. They've been really impressive. If the Brewers came along and offered the Marlins someone like Bryce Turang or something for him, which I don't think they would ever do, then you'd probably have to consider it. But assuming it's just 2 middling prospects from a subpar Brewer system, I just don't think that makes sense for him. So it's going to be depending on the offer and depending on where the Marlins are at. But to answer the question more directly as to how it pertains to next year, that plays a part in it, right? But I think regardless, you're kind of looking to move on from Aguilar, which makes it hard for me to say because I really do like him. But I do believe that Garrett Cooper is obviously, he's more versatile. He can play outfield. He's not the best outfielder in the world, but he's more versatile in that regard. And you can play first base. You can play outfield if you're Cooper. That helps the Marlins a little bit, especially with some of the questions they might have moving forward with the outfield. So if Lewin Diaz is struggling, then Cooper can go to first base. If Lewin Diaz hits the ground running, and I thought he's looked really good in his limited action in the bigs and has really started to figure it out in AAA, then you have Cooper anchoring a corner outfield spot. And we'll see what the DH situation is as well. That plays a component. But if there is no DH again, because baseball can't stop, you know, just you can't get out of its own way, then Cooper even makes it even more of a no-brainer, in my opinion, because of his ability to play right field, first base. And you can kind of figure out, as those are going to be 2 question marks for the Marlins coming up in this coming season, is where will the prospects be for them? And will they be able to slot into the corner outfield spots? But also, first base is going to be a question as well. So you can have Cooper as the answer to either question for whichever one isn't answered. Hopefully one of the 2 is answered. Of course, I'm going to talk about the draft a little bit too as I'm scrolling through some of these questions. But the next question is from my man TWM, and then I'm going to talk about the Sixto Sanchez situation. So TWM, takes were made on Twitter, probably one of my favorite accounts out there. He asks what the best place for Jazz is in the lineup, and why does he have so much more success when hitting down in the lineup? This is one that I can only give an educated guess, and that is as good as I can do given the still somewhat small sample size, and also just there's just so many little like nuances that go into it. It could be something as simple as the fact that it's just mental, right? He's just more comfortable hitting 6th instead of 1st. But I'm not going to just give you that cop-out answer because I know I'll have a DM from the TWM account within a second of me publishing this saying you copped out on that answer. So I'll give you an actual answer and an actual theory here, because this is what I think it could be. Is when we think about when Jazz Chisholm is able to go against the shift, right? He's able to go the other way pretty effectively, but we also have a bit of confirmation bias there. We're going to remember the times that he goes inside out into left field for an RBI single more than we're going to remember the groundouts to second base. And what I can tell you about this is that Jazz Chisholm, he does not get shifted a ton, but he does get shifted more than a quarter of the time. That's still below league average, but what's interesting about this is that Jazz gets shifted more when there's nobody on base, right? Because you can go into whatever defense you want. You don't have to worry about holding runners on. It's a bit different. So when Jazz is hitting leadoff, he tends to be shifted more. And if you look at the spray charts, a vast majority of his outs are poolside ground balls to second base. It really is. A majority of his outs are poolside ground balls to second base. So there's a reason why they're shifting, right? They're not just saying, oh, he's a lefty that hits for power. I don't know what the batted ball data is, but let's just shift him anyways, right? I mean, these teams are much smarter than that. So there's a reason why they shift him. The difference is that when you're batting leadoff, most of the time, or at least early in the game, when you get up, and especially in the National League, because pitchers never get hit, you are going to often come up with nobody on base. And I do like that for Jazz in terms of the fact that he sees more fastballs to hit, maybe not as many breaking balls as he would see in another spot. But that being said, it's still a challenge for him because he is hitting more balls into the ground over to second base where he's being shifted. And if you look at the numbers, when he is being shifted, his WOBA, or weighted on base average, is 298 when he is being shifted. When he's not being shifted, it's 340. So there's definitely a big difference. And he has a bit more of a hole on the right side. We know how much he likes to yank hard ground balls that get through there. Yes, he can go the other way. He's more than capable of doing that. And I'm not saying the shift is going to kill Jazz Chisholm, but as he develops as a hitter, he's just going to have to be even more focused on hitting against the shift in the leadoff spot. Maybe that's not something you want to put on him right now, as he's also focused on just being able to hit the breaking ball. He's a 300 hitter against the fastball, hitting just .157 against the breaking ball. So maybe you want him to just focus on having better plate discipline, and maybe that's why it might be better to have him in the six hole, because he has been a lot better in that six hole where he's hitting .263 with a .975 OPS, and that's in 48 plate appearances. A lot more plate appearances in the leadoff spot, 183 of them, where he's hitting .244 with a .668 OPS. And that's the difference, right? But it's also not the biggest sample size ever. You have two good games in the sixth spot, and that could be the difference. So it's also really hard to micromanage those sample sizes, but I will say that he is grounded out on the pull side more than people think. He has a high ground ball rate. His pull rate's not egregious, but that's the way he's going to get himself out more often than not. And that's really, I think, the big thing that's impeding him from being as productive in the leadoff spot. I still like him there because he's going to see more fastballs, but if that is more of a problem where he's trying too hard to hit away from the shift, or that he's just hitting right into it regardless, then maybe you got to look to put him in situations where he might not get shifted totally as much, but he has more than enough tools to be able to hit through it, and I'm not too concerned about it. But even if you look at his spray charts, his hits, most of them are up the middle or the other way for base hits. Not that many singles are on the pull side because of the fact that he is, you know, defended well in that regard. I know I mentioned I was going to talk about Sixto Sanchez, but we're already at 36 minutes, so I'm going to save that for the next episode. I don't have that much to discuss in that regard anyways. Just a little bit of my thoughts on that as somebody that had the shoulder surgery and also just knows what that whole process was like. It might be a little bit different. I know it's not quite as bad as it's only a partial tear, so I want to talk about that and how the Marlins managed that situation. It's a little bit weird, and that's more so the topic that I want to discuss, so I'll save that for tomorrow's episode. But as always, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode being a little bit longer. If you didn't, then I'm sorry that it was a little bit longer, and we'll go shorter next time, but we'll try to keep it under 30 minutes moving forward. Thank you for listening. Look forward to the rest of this Dodgers-Marlins series, and I look forward to talking Marlins baseball with you tomorrow.